Welcome to the Big Green Politics Podcast. Extraordinary times in UK politics, dominated by Brexit, elections, and old school politics. In the midst of all of this, where do the Greens stand? Julie explored these topics and questions with Steve Hind, a longtime Green activist and campaigner who also works for MEP for the South West England. Take a listen and enjoy.
Thanks for coming onto the podcast, Steve.
It's an absolute pleasure to be here. Thank you.
You've worked in the political arena in the UK for quite a few years now. So you've experienced firsthand the roller coaster that has been UK politics in the past few years. The Green surge, Corbyn's rise to power, two general elections in 2 years, Brexit. What's your sense of the current state of play of British politics?
So I think we're in quite an extraordinary time. I think it's very easy to paint where we are today as being just a slight exaggeration, a slight extension of what we've seen in the past. But I'm seeing some fundamental shifts, really, in how we do politics in this country. And it feels to me like the two main parties, the Conservatives and the Labour Party, are really struggling to keep up with this. So because of the nature of our electoral system, the first-past-the-post system, we've got dominated in councils, in regional authorities, and in Parliament. We've got this domination of Conservative and Labour MPs. And at the same time, these elected representatives are trying to keep up and to represent what feels to me an increasingly polarised form of politics. And so what we're seeing is that both parties are being stretched in a way that they're deeply uncomfortable with. And we can see this at the moment, most starkly with the Conservatives in power trying to deal with the Brexit divide within their own party. They're trying to placate the extremists, really, I'd call them, the Jacob Rees-Moggs of the world, whilst at the same time trying to still credibly claim to be a party of business. And you can see that this is really deeply uncomfortable for them. You can see that it's putting the structures that our politics have been built on really under strain. And so as a result, what we see, and I think we see this all across Europe actually, is often the parties that did dominate and fight over the centre ground, like it was the old adage, I think, of traditional British politics, that to win an election, you had to win the centre ground. And that's what Blair did to win 97. They came across as the credible centre ground Labour Party. But really, it feels to me like the centre ground has at best been ignored and at worst has been abandoned. And this has created a real rupture in our politics with a democratic system like first past the post that necessitates winning the centre ground to win elections. There's this extraordinary situation where neither party is really effectively claiming that centre ground. And that's, I think, partly explains the stalemate that we find ourselves in. The other thing that I wanted to talk about then was maybe the rise of the rise of the extremes, or those that sit away from the centre ground of British politics. And as you quite rightly said, we'd experienced the Green surge in the UK, and that was very exciting for a few years. But we've also at the same time seen the rise of UKIP and how they've now morphed under their current leader into an undeniably far-right faction, an extremist group with extreme and I'd say dangerous ideologies. And so I just wanted to pull out a little bit about how, especially as Greens and Green sympathisers who want to change a system, who want to bring about quite radical change, but how we have to have our guard up against what type of radical politics we're talking about. And as Greens, we always have, I think, to be incredibly strong about how we guard the foundations of our democracy, we guard the structures and the checks and balances, the separation of the judiciary, the free press, all of these things that we should cherish in our free society. And as Greens, we're talking about how we can evolve them and change them, not blow them up and replace them with something far, far worse, which is obviously what I feel to be the UKIP system. And then I just had one other point, if I can carry on waxing lyrical. And that's really about how even as we've seen a lot of the old rules get thrown out of British politics, you know, UKIP especially, I think, are to blame for this in many ways, about how you do politics, about common decency, about respecting other people's opinions. So we've seen all of these rules kind of washed away, really, and mainstream politicians buying into this new way of doing politics, which I find to be deeply worrying. But even in this new era, we've still got a complete inability for politicians to talk about climate change in any way that isn't just a cheap add-on at election times. There's still a real fundamental failing to be able to see the systemic change that we need to bring about. So even with our resident experts in the IPCC report coming out this last week saying that we need to see fundamental drastic change in the next decade, there was nods and smiles in agreement with this, but there was no, okay, so this fundamentally means that we need to change the way we do politics. There was no real comprehension of that. And for me, again, this is a sign of an old political system really struggling to keep up with the changing times and the changing priorities that we collectively as a country and as a world are facing. And that's about, for me, the big thing then is about strengthening our democracy, bringing about a careful but radical transition. And, you know, this has to be about environmentalism. And still, until the two big parties really get their head around the need for environmentalism, I think they'll just be playing catch up.
So do you think this increased polarisation that we're seeing in the UK and across Europe to some extent, and which obviously worked well for the Greens in Bavaria last weekend, who did really well, to the expense of the centre left, do you think the Greens can capitalise on this?
Absolutely. So I think as we're on the as we're on a Green podcast, we should just do a big shout out for, you know, how well we have done as Greens. I think something that died in the Labour movement a decade ago was this sense of internationalism, this sort of sense of worker solidarity across the world. You know, we saw Ed Miliband with the controls on immigration mug in 2015. And for me, that was sort of the death nail of this, of what was, I think, a very proud Labour movement of internationalism. And I think in Greens, we've got elements of this, but we need to, at the same time as we focus on subsidiarity, about focusing everything at the most local level possible, I think we also have to celebrate this internationalism. So I think it's right and proper that here we give a shout out to Bavaria, to Munich, to Luxembourg, to the city of Brussels, where we both used to live for various times, that have seen massive historic highs for Greens. And that's really exciting, I think, for us. You know, it shows that when Greens offer compassionate, real change rooted in real politics that can bring about policy change, I think people see this and they like it. And that's really exciting. And I think that's something that, yeah, as British Greens, we can definitely learn from. People aren't scared of change per se. I think if you frame it right for them, then I think people are susceptible to the Green message.
For the Greens, the various Green parties in the UK right now, they had this surge of support in 2015, and then when Corbyn was elected as leader of the Labour Party, the surge slowed down very much, and since then it's been quite tough. Where do you think they're at?
So for me, I'm going to use a visual idea of the Green surge, and that's of the bell curve, really. So we saw a very, very dramatic, steep rise in Green support through 2014 and 2015, tripling membership of the party and really rising to historic highs in the nationwide polling. And it also saw us do incredibly well in the general election as well, re-electing Caroline Lucas with a massive majority and seeing surges all across the country, including here in Bristol. In Bristol West, they got 27% of the vote in Bristol West. So it was a really sort of huge surge and very exciting. But then what we did see was that how that Green surge dropped off again. And I think it is, you drew out in the question about the sort of correlation between Corbynism and Corbyn's rise to power. And I think Corbyn does offer something slightly different. And I can see why that did appeal to people that were getting behind the Green Party, or at the very least were offering the Greens their vote in 2015. I could see why then, for some people, Corbyn was an attractive proposition to them. And, you know, I want to be very clear about this, because I feel like lots of people, especially in the Green movement, feel threatened by Corbyn and what he stands for. And I think this is I think this is ridiculous. And, you know, and like people talk sometimes about how Corbyn has stolen the green ideas. You know, they've stolen Green's 2015 election as if we had unique property rights over it. It's nonsense. Corbyn is broadly a good thing for politics. He's showing that there's an appetite out there for something that is different to that manufactured, in the words of Jonathan and Sian, our co-leaders, vapid centrism, you know? Like, there is a demand, there is a need for something different to that. And he's showing that. And he's showing that, you know what, like, arguments around radical redistribution of wealth, about protecting the most vulnerable in our society, that this is attractive, and this is attractive to a new generation getting involved in politics. And so, as Greens, I think we should massively, massively celebrate all of that. But I would also say that in the era of Corbyn, there is a need for Greens that are stronger than ever. And this is where I guess I would strongly disagree with Corbyn and probably a lot of Corbyn's quite hardcore supporters, and that I feel that plural politics is good, healthy politics, in enabling an environment where you can have discussions and you can have debates and then the best policies come through. I think this is positive and this should be celebrated. And, you know, it's Caroline Lucas has stood on the stage times and times again and said, you know, nobody has a monopoly on good ideas. And that is really, really true. But what we've seen with green politics is that we've been the incubator of good ideas. We hold good ideas and we let them grow. We nurture radical ideas, things that wouldn't fit into the mainstream two parties in any way. Mm. We hold on to them, we grow them, until suddenly people look around and see the things we've grown and gone, yeah, that's actually a really exciting, interesting prospect. And we think that's something that we should be considering. You know, I mean, I've talked positively about Corbyn here. He's not the messiah. He's not the answer to all our ills. I've talked earlier on in this podcast already about how Labour still seems to struggle to grasp climate change as anything other than a cheap add-on. There are these concerns, and I think the need for a strong green voice in British politics is there more than ever as we continue, I think, to lead the way in talking and in bringing about electoral change, about environmental change, and about social change. These are core green messages that make up our holistic identity as Greens. And, you know, we'll be consistent with this in a way that I don't feel like other political parties in the UK will be. And we should be proud that we play that role. And I don't think there's any cowering away or hiding from some of the stuff that Corbyn's done. I think we should just be saying we're offering something different. We overlap in big areas, and of course we want to work closely with Corbyn and the Labour Party, and if when Labour forms a government, that will be a much, much more progressive prospect than the zombie Conservative government that we have at the moment. But more than ever, we need more green councillors elected, we need more regional leaders, we need mayors, we need leaders of councils, and of course we need more green voices like Caroline Lucas in Parliament.
And so do you think that the Greens can go back to the role that they had, I suppose, before 2010, which was being the radical voice on the edge, rather than occupying the left centre ground of politics where they're the only ones being anti-austerity or kind of talking about solid left-wing ideas when Labour wasn't? Do you think now the Greens can go back to pushing for really forward-looking, quite radical ideas like basic income, land value tax, radical ecology? Do you think that's their role now?
So I'd say partly. I mean, so I would challenge slightly, I guess, the basis of your question about the idea that the Greens somehow stopped making these radical suggestions. I feel like the Greens have consistently been doing that, even when Labour were wandering around in no man's land. It feels slightly sort of the post-Gordon Brown era of this sort of Labour soul-searching as they sort of moped and tried to work out what their identity was. And yeah, I don't feel like there's a particular inconsistency there. Like, I feel like we have been consistent, and I feel like that's one of the core things that we as Greens now have to communicate, really, is that as Greens, we have a published set of principles. You know, like, you can look online, you can see our philosophical basis, you can see our short-term policy aims, and you can see our long-term policy aims. We're the only party that consistently has that available online for anyone to see and offer that transparency. And as a result, we've got, I think, that consistent long-term thread that pulls us into the future, that leads us in a consistent direction. There's no blowing about with the current political winds, you know, like, is this going to be popular? Does that play well? There's no being dictated by a powerful central leader's office. You know, like, what does the leader think about this and changing policy one way or another? As Greens, we've been incredibly consistent and we'll always be incredibly consistent. And that's really, I think, about being hardworking local representatives. So in last May in the UK, we had our most successful local election results that we've ever had before. We've got more councillors elected across England, Wales now than we've ever had before. But it's also about this sort of core identity, about how we keep a degree of compassion within our politics. For a party that is called the Green Party and has environmentalism at its heart, we're also incredibly people-focused. A lot of our work is around, it's about well-being and happiness and really trying to find that balance in societies and in a wider ecological sense, about how do we find balance in our existence, of how we manage. We're at a time with unprecedented standards of living, really, in the UK. And for me, there's just a very simple goal that we should be going for. And that's about, one, how can we enjoy this? How can we get as many people to enjoy this standard of living? You know, like, we've got running water coming into our houses. We've got food coming from all over the world that's nutritional and tasty coming to us. All of our basic needs are served up to us on a plate. And yet, we've designed a system where we spend most of our time sitting in an office behind a computer trying to keep up with emails. It's just madness. It's complete madness. And, you know, and that's why Green's talking about things like four-day weeks, you know, like, to enable us to have more time at weekends to do things that actually make us happy, is really, really important. It's about enjoying and enabling us to have to make the most of this unprecedented positive moment in history that we're at. But then I'd say there's a second priority, and this is where I would say only Greens really get this as an issue, which is about, how do we protect this for our future generations? You know, like, we're not just talking about being hedonists. We're not just talking about using up all the world's resources as quickly as possible for the fun of that one particular moment. This is about how we can protect this quality of life and this beautiful and fragile planet Earth that we have for future generations. Mm. And I think, as a political vision, for me, that seems pretty appealing. Mm. Like, how do we manage to have fun today, and how do we manage to not fuck it up for future generations? Mm. That seems pretty simple to me. And that seems, I think if you say it in those terms, I think that's a political vision that a lot of people would feel like they can get on board with as well.
I feel like that although radical change is what the Greens do offer in some way, that feels very threatening to many people, and that protecting nature, protecting institutions, protecting people's rights, which is also very much part of green philosophy, does appeal to a much broader spectrum of people. Do you think that's effective messaging, or do you think that doesn't really translate how much we want to change everything?
If you went out onto the high street today and talked to people about trying to get a 50% reduction in car use, okay, most people would reel back against that. Because most people would hear, we're asking people who currently get in their car and drive to not get in their car and drive. If you talk to people about protecting their children as they're walking to school from basic air quality, that seems like something that people would want. It seems like something that they would get on board with. So it's a little bit about how you package it. But I think the key thing, and this is where maybe sort of a deep-rooted Greens would maybe have an issue with what I was saying, is that they would say, well, this compromise of language would lead to a compromise of policy. And so as Greens, and especially Greens who work for elected officials or elected councillors, I think you've got to be sure, you know, that it's you changing the system and it's not the system changing you. Like, as you go and you work in politics, it's been described to me before, it's like the art of the possible, you know. It's about how you bring together different forces and you come out with a good, positive policy outcome. And that inherently means compromise, it inherently means listening. But how do you do that, really, without a constant compromise and grinding down into the acceptance of the system that we've got and that we currently operate with? And that's a really hard question for a party like the Greens, who have this really quite different and quite positive radical vision for an alternative society. How do you work towards that in a system that's so geared up to maintain the status quo, which, as we know, is deeply undesirable because of the inequalities, because of the environmental damage, and because of all of the things that as Greens we rally against.
Okay, so maybe we should talk about the dreaded B word, Brexit.
Yeah.
As you've been working on that quite a lot in the past couple of years working for an MEP, what's going to happen?
Fuck knows. I said I was going to swear, didn't I? I mean, but honestly...
You didn't warn me.
Honestly, fuck knows. Like, it's so up in the air. It's an unprecedented level of fuck knows. That's where we're at right now. We're an unprecedented level of fuck knows. So... But what I
right.
but the one thing that I guess we can say for 100% certain, 100% certain, is that I know, and I think when you actually start talking to people, other people know that this is something that's really worth fighting for. Okay, so mm-hmm. I think a lot of the people still now, even with all of these dire warnings floating around, there's a head in the sand phenomena. You know, there's a swallowing of the rhetoric about it being the will of the people, and so therefore we have to fulfill the will of the people, and actually. You know what? If you know or you feel that this is going to be as bad as you think it is, if you're imagining, you know, the strain that this is having on people's relationships who've got family or friends or loved ones living abroad, if you know that it's somebody who works in the automotive industry that relies on a just-in-time supply chain, like all the Honda workers in Swindon, if you know that jobs are being put at risk, if you know that government's own figures are suggesting that between a 2 and 8% drop in GDP, depending on the nature of the Brexit deal that we get, if you know that something so fundamental is going to be shifting, then surely it's worth fighting for. Mm. And that's really, I think, where we've got to be at the moment as Greens. We have got to be galvanising people. I mean, there's huge momentum now around this idea of a people's vote. And that, for me, is great. This is about how we harness this energy now. Because what we can't afford to do is have another 6 months of a passive non-response. You know, we have a responsibility to not let our country walk off a cliff. Those who live next door to us in France and in Ireland, like, they're not our enemies. These are our friends. They are often now our families. And you know what? They are still our biggest trading bloc. You know, like, this is the slightly crazy thing we've got where Greens are sat there talking about defending the jobs of the automotive industry in Swindon, you know? But this this is a really key thing. And I guess this would be a good time to momentarily address the Lexiteers, the left-wing people that want to leave the European Union's point. Okay, so as Greens, we're trying to do something incredibly difficult. I heard Molly at a talk recently describe it as trying to transition a helicopter into a plane in midair. And those who want us to leave the European Union are just suggesting that we blow the helicopter up as if that might help us then reassemble it. We could think of a more green example, like a car going along that we want to resemble and reassemble into a bike. Like, we're trying to do something really, really difficult by just blowing up the entire system as we know it isn't going to help us make this transition. What we need is an ambitious but very clear transition strategy. Mm-hmm. Okay, and what we've already seen is that actually businesses, people's lifestyles, the energy that we use, our transport modes, they can transition. You know, like, we can see really big transitions if we give people the support and the time in which to do that. So, I mean, a really small example here in Bristol, we've seen that number of people using their bike as their main form of commute has shifted in the last decade from about 3% up to about 15%. There was nothing, I would say this, there's nothing overly radical about what's happened here, and that clearly we need to do more and go further. But what that showed was that if you consistently put a small amount of money into building better cycle lane infrastructure, if you consistently did awareness raising campaigns, more people, their behaviour change would just slowly come about. And then you think, okay, if this can be achieved through what I would consider to be the pretty minimal input, you know, you start thinking that, well, actually, if we got really, really sort of bigger thinking, if we scaled up the amount of money that we could invest in it, if we scaled up the whole thinking, then there's huge potential for how we can transition. But I can't emphasize this enough. This is about transitioning. And to go back to that original metaphor, leaving the European Union isn't a transition. It is putting a bomb underneath the whole economy. You know, like what happens when 2-8% of GDP drops away? Because I mean, I think for lots of people, this feels like such an abstract idea. You know, like, should I care that 8% of our GDP drops away? And the answer is yes, absolutely. When you look at like our healthcare system that's really struggling under chronic underfunding under this zombie conservative government. I'm calling it a zombie government, by the way, because it does nothing. It's a dead government walking. It's completely paralyzed and it can't do anything. It can't do anything conservative. It can't do anything radical. It can't do anything. And so what we've got is this chronic underfunding of our healthcare system. We've got waiting lists going through the roof. We've got shortages of nurses. We've got shortages of doctors. We've got buildings that are literally crumbling. And then there are people thinking, well, okay, so maybe if we just had this massive drop in the economy, you know, so that the amount of tax coming in would massively drop away. You know, obviously this then leads to a cut in the quality of our public services. So it's not just about losing jobs in the City of London and financing. It's not just about car manufacturing jobs disappearing, which in of themselves are a disaster to those families and the people working in those industries. But there's also a much wider societal impact about the revenue that government brings in and what that this can be potentially spent on in the future. Mm. And again, I would extend this argument to sort of any Corbyn supporter that thinks we're better off outside the European Union, and potentially even Corbyn himself, who I think probably does think we're better off outside the European Union, that even if we get a fraction of the drop in GDP that the government's predicting, that in fact all major credible economic forecasting organisations are predicting, then this will be a real disaster for any future Labour or progressive vision of government that involves spending more money. Mm. So to the sort of tax rises that we'd have to see to make up this deficit drop would be absolutely huge and unpalatable at a time when people's quality of lives are already being hit in such a hard way. Greens fundamentally believe in a high tax, high welfare society. That's our vision for it. But if your economy is going down the toilet at the same time and your revenues that are being brought in are disappearing, this makes it incredibly hard for your average Joe who's just lost their job down the Honda factory to then be able to sort of swallow an increase in taxation for what would ultimately then be probably plugging gaps in public service spending. And just to be really clear, like, we're not talking about manufacturing companies like Honda disappearing on the moment that Brexit happens. We're not talking about them packing their bags and leaving, although some companies have already packed up and left. What we're talking about really here is about the investment in Britain as we transition, again, that word, transition our economy into something that we want in the future. So if I was sat in the Honda boardroom now, I wouldn't be thinking, where can I cut jobs? But it's about where do they invest money? Okay, so in Honda, Swindon, for example, they're developing hydrogen cars there at the moment. And they'll be looking to invest a huge amount of money over the coming years and decades into developing this as a feasible technology that could be expanded up. And so there's a question of, do we want companies like that investing that money into Britain to build an economy that's suitable, to move us in the direction that we as a society want to be moving in the future? Or do we try and just desperately defend the jobs of the 20th century that are still hanging around long enough? And we know from history that that's not enough. You can't just defend the jobs of the past. We need to be building an economy of the future. Mm. And again, this is where I would say that strong green voices calling for this, calling for green renewable jobs, is the way forward. There's a really great example at the port of Hull at the moment, where Hull was a traditional very strong dock city that where a huge amount of trade going through it, and then this obviously was impacted, and they've transitioned into being a green technology hub there, where they now produce a really large number of wind turbine blades. And this has really revitalized the area and brought new funding and investments into the area. And this is what we're talking about Greens. You know, it's about using the existing skills and the existing infrastructure to build something that's much more exciting and I think much more future-proof.
Mm.
And again, I'll just go back to the point, to bring it all the way back to Brexit, that becomes very, very hard to do if you sit outside the single market and the customs union.
But that's what people voted for, Steve.
It's the will of the people, Julia.
It's the will of the people.
It's the will of the people. And of course, you know, okay, so what did people vote for? Let's just rehearse this back again. Or this feels like all I've been talking about for the last 2 years. So what did people vote for? They voted for Britain to leave the European Union by 52% to 48%. I mean, first thing to say is that democracy, however much those who want us to leave the European Union, doesn't stop at any one moment. Mm-hmm. And so I think we have an obligation as a country to, on something so fundamental, such a big constitutional change as this, to make sure that we're getting it right, that this is, quote unquote, the will of the people. So you can quote the will of the people until you're blue in the face, but you have to be sure that this is the will of the people. If, I mean, I've just talked in a painfully long-winded monologue for the last 10 minutes in this podcast about the potential damage of Brexit, you know. And so if you're taking us down this route where your own departments are making these predictions about how bad it's going to be, then you surely have a responsibility. If your core argument is this is the will of the people and therefore we have to do it, you must be absolutely sure that you really are representing the will of the people. And honestly, I just don't think that the specific nature of a negotiated Brexit deal will be the will of the people. Because what we know through polling analysis and through experts that are analysing the makeup of that 52% is that what we actually saw was an unholy alliance of people and interests that had quite contradictory views about why they wanted Britain to leave the European Union and what that should look like. And, you know, as at this time, I think what we should be doing is looking to build a unity policy for the way forward of this. And for me, this has to be about going back to the people. It has to be having a people's vote offering a range of options, because I don't think in most people's eyes Parliament really holds a legitimacy to be able to make such a big decision at the moment. I don't think pragmatically there's a majority of MPs that would be willing to vote for any deal. And I think there will be huge unrest and unease about what decision goes forward. So, yeah, I would go back to this argument that almost whatever happens to get us out of this constitutional mess, this economic mess, and actually, let's be honest, this social mess where neighbours are distrusting neighbours, where Brexiteers and Remainers are finding it harder and harder to talk to each other, let alone get along with each other. I think we do need to go back and reiterate what we mean by this phrase, the will of the people. And we absolutely can't just let Theresa May, for her own political survival, get to define what this means. Mm. Like, that's the bottom line of what we absolutely can't do.
One argument against having another people's vote is that people are already so angry and divided, society so polarised, that this would make people so angry and bring people out in the streets en masse. And we already see a rise of the far right to some extent in the UK, with figures like Tommy Robinson getting a lot of press coverage, and it's mirroring what's going on all over Europe and all over the world to some extent. Is that a worry that you have in terms of Brexit, in terms of alienating a section of the society and of the population that was already angry?
So, absolutely. I would say this is a risk, and anyone who cares about Britain and Britain's future in the world has to take this risk very seriously. I would say that's why we have to, whatever pathway we go going forward, it has to be working alongside this idea of strengthening our democratic structures and not letting anything slip through that weakens those democratic structures. I think part of the reason the take back control narrative held so much weight in people's mind was because people do feel out of control. And part of this was, again, like linking all the way back to the beginning of this podcast, when I was talking about sort of the old politics struggling to keep up with a changing world. I think that partly reflects on it, you know, right? When our data is being splashed all around the internet and we have no control over it, when we're being targeted by advertising, when our finances seem so abstract in concepts of debt rather than the money actually in our pockets. I think people broadly in this new world are feeling out of control. And so a very crass sort of narrative about taking back control and was obviously very, very appealing to people. And so as we push forward for the people's vote, which again, I would say is a strengthening of democracy at this moment, I think in general, we need to be very cautious about referendums. But if you're asking me about the pathway of how we get out of this quagmire of politics that we're currently in, that this deeply irresponsible Conservative government has led us into, I would argue that a people's vote is one of the few democratically legitimate ways that we can get out of this quagmire of a political, economic and social mess that we're in. But again, I would say that this would only work if we can be actively seen to be strengthening democratic structures rather than weakening it. So I would be arguing that now is the time to be looking at proportional representation, for example. When people don't feel like they have control, I would include that in a democratic system that ignores the majority of votes. You know, like, what say do you have over a political system if you live in a safe seat? Absolutely none. You know in the heart of your heart that however you vote, it'll make no difference to who forms a government. It makes for lazy MPs, even your local representatives, the stalwarts of first-past-the-post political system. You have a local representative you can go to. We know that in safe seats, this makes them lazy. There's no need for them to really actively go out and listen to their constituents and work out what the big issues are for them, because they know that stick a rosette on come election time, they're going to get re-elected in those safe seats. This can't be good for democracy, and it can't be good for our political system. So there needs to be a much wider conversation, really, about how we both strengthen our democracy and how we move it into the 21st century to be able to tackle the big issues that we're facing, about how in an age where we've been told that we have a decade to basically put a stop to climate change, like, how do we do this? How do we do this in a way that does reflect a genuine democratic mandate? Like, these are really big, hard questions. And again, I'll just double back to this point that the way I can say for sure we don't do it is just by insisting what we've got is good enough. Mm-hmm. That because the system of democracy that we've used in the UK got us through the 20th century, therefore it's fine for the 21st century. I'd say absolutely not. I'd say, again, we'll go back to this word transition, which seems to be the buzzword of this podcast. We have to find a way of transitioning our democracy into a stronger and more stable state. And at the moment, for me, that's arguing against Brexit and arguing that we need to be staying in perhaps the most stable democratic structure that we have, and that's the European Union. And I know that'd be hugely controversial for a lot of the people listening to this to say that for me, it's about strengthening democracy to stay in the European Union. But for me, that's a really key point at the moment. It is democratic. It is perhaps our biggest trading bloc. It is, at the moment, the epitome of democratic stability. And that, I think, we should hold on to for really dear life at the moment, as we then look to transition into a more radical and more progressive society, democratic and economic system.
All right, folks, if you enjoyed that interview, check out our previous interviews on topics like European politics and political ecology, or the link between race equality and environmentalism. You can follow us on Twitter at Big Green Pop Pod, and if you haven't already, subscribe to the show so you can hear it every 2 weeks. You can find us on any podcast platform. Thanks so much, and see you in 2 weeks.